Welcome to the Vita Voices Power to Empower podcast series, where we're speaking with women leaders from around the world about their bold ideas, their courageous leadership, and their thoughts on the way forward. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Elise Nelson.
Resilience, inclusion are both keys to building systems and policies and democracies that work for all of us. And those are two keys to Sandra Pepra's career experience. Sandra is a career diplomat and an international development professional currently serving as the National Democratic Institute's Director for Gender, Women, and Democracy. Prior to her current role, she spent 13 years as a senior officer at the UK's Department for International Development. She's a renowned political analyst and public speaker with impactful experience in political science, international relations, diplomacy, risk analysis, corporate governance, and more. And what I love about her career is that she's always kept women at the heart of her work. Sandra, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today.
Well, thank you, Elise, for inviting me. I'm very excited for this conversation.
Aww. And you, of course, are such a friend and ally to me and to Vital Voices in this space. It's a real pleasure to welcome you on the podcast. Your career has really spanned so many impressive accomplishments and different topics. But, you know, I'd love to start off by talking about your path to advocating for gender equality. Can you talk about how you became involved in the field? Like, was there a aha moment, a series of moments? Was it something you always knew you needed to champion?
Well, Elise, I think like yourself, you know, I was born to it. My parents gave me a strong sense of equality, really. And I think more than gender equality, I think that the fight for justice and equality has been something that I've been raised with my whole life. I went to an all-girls school, and so it was very much as if I was raised with a feminist sort of mind frame, I think I would have to say. Now, of course, you know, I'm Black, and I was raised in a white-dominated society. I was raised in the UK. I'm British, class-ridden as well. So there are issues there with how your upbringing frames your worldview. But I was hugely privileged even in that context. And the issue of how my race has also impacted my feminism is probably a completely separate podcast. We'd have to have another session. But I've been fortunate to be able to work with the mission that has meant so much to me my whole life. I'm blessed in that.
And certainly leading it at NDI, NDI for years, of course, decades, has been working with political leaders, but more recently, and it's not that recent, but more recently in its larger history, really developed out this program specifically for women political leaders. Can you talk about why that's important, that it not just be embedded throughout, but why it's important to actually have an expert, a department within this larger organization that's looking at and supporting the political landscape from free and fair elections to, you know, helping, you know, those run for office to good governance. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, I always say, Elisa, you know, I'm jealous of you because you know, you are in a woman-centered, woman-run, woman-led organization. And I have the privilege of leading the women's rights unit within a much more complex, heterosexual, actually firmly male-dominated organization. So our modus operandi really starts with organizational change. I always say to get out of the building with gender-informed democracy programming, we have to first persuade, cajole, bribe, bully our colleagues to develop the programming that supports it. So it's a constant process of organizational change internally in order to deliver on our mission, which is inclusive and resilient democracy for all. And I, you know, at least we have the same narrative around the importance of the broadest possible perspective, and women are 51% of that broad perspective. They're also 50% of every single other demographic group. So, you know, democracy cannot really be attained if you don't have the ability and the access, the voice and agency of women being presented through all those, as you said, institutions and processes and in their leadership.
You know, as you look across the world, what changes do you see? I mean, I think for some people maybe who don't have the privilege that we have of getting to work with women leaders and see that great progress, they probably look at this larger space and think, you know, progress has been really slow. We also know that the global pandemic set women back by what, another generation, 36 mm-hmm. years mm-hmm. longer to before we get to gender equality. So says the World Economic Forum's mm-hmm. gender gap report. But I think, you know, often those big numbers miss the nuances of what is going on in countries around the world. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't that long ago when we were seeing the first woman, first head of state in Africa, mm-hmm. the first head of state in Latin America, the first woman on a major, you know, party as a major party candidate in the United States. You know, so we have seen some of those big shifts. I think the way that women even think about politics has changed. I remember years ago, women talking about, well, politics is dirty, you know. But mm-hmm. then, you know, working on the local councils, you know, and improving their communities, all of a sudden recognizing, wait a minute, you know, we do more, you know, just in civil society for making the community better than our elected politicians who have their resources allocated to do so. So what do you see in terms of those shifts from your vantage point, obviously working across the world? You know, what are some of those big changes and shifts that you've seen in your time?
Well, I think the numbers, we can't, you know, we cavil that it's only 26% of all parliamentarians globally are women, but that's a huge step forward in half a century, less actually. And it is, of course, the mechanism generally that has really driven the dynamic around numbers is quotas, the introduction of quotas. And there are, probably more than half the world's jurisdictions now have some form of either gender or women's quota, which attempts to address the numerical issue. Of course, I always say, and I have to acknowledge, I think we should all acknowledge, that what quotas haven't done is catalyze that self-sustaining dynamic about women's ability to participate in increasingly large numbers in their own right in these formal political spaces. So I think numbers we can't cavil at. I also think that despite the fact that young women are still the least represented in formal politics, in the space for civil society action, which you absolutely rightly included in the pantheon of political action, what we are seeing actually is a lot of young faces and a lot of young women at the forefront of some of these big political movements, and some of them risking their lives in ways that are terrifying and awe-inspiring at the same time. So I think there is a greater sense of urgency amongst young women really across the world. They're just on fire, and we have to acknowledge that. And then I think the other area is a broad change. Again, you mentioned it, a broad change in the perspectives on women's leadership. Now, the problem with that, and you know this as well as I do, is that regression is always possible. We think we've made progress, and then you suddenly find that in places where we thought we'd won this battle, then there are reversals. And so being careful and mindful to shore up that progress in ways that prevent the reversals. And that is going to take not only women being in leadership, but also making sure that our institutional and legal frameworks are correct, but continuing to press the pedal on changing the sociocultural norms and behaviors around women's leadership as well.
You know, when I think about the impact of this global pandemic, of this crisis, it obviously has had a disproportionate impact on women in terms of loss of job and increased caretaking responsibilities. And we've seen this huge exodus, certainly in this country, but in other places as well, women from the workforce. What has happened in terms of women in the political space? Are you seeing women kind of coming out of this crisis saying, I'm gonna run, or I need to do more, I'm gonna run for that higher office, I'm gonna get more engaged, or are you seeing them retreat?
It's a push me, pull you thing, isn't it? Because for all the reasons that you set out, you know, high numbers of unemployment from the COVID shock, this massive increase in the care burden that girls and women are facing, and frankly, the spike in violence against women and girls that we've seen through this. So all of these things would in any case impact women's ability to participate in politics. But then you add some of the kind of legal and jurisdictional issues around states of emergency, the excuses made to roll back rights, apparently, to support COVID responses, and a longer term dynamic whereby women's rights, gender equality has come under assault and attack by authoritarians and illiberals. So I think the 135 years from Davos, I love it when Davos gives us these figures, because this is no hotbed of feminist radicalism. And so if they're calling a warning, it's got to be bad. All of these things, as I said, would impact women's ability to participate in politics. But my colleague Caroline Hubbard and Saskia Breckenmacher at Carnegie actually did a piece of research on women and elections. And they were seeing some of those habits and behaviors that we had thought we had overcome in terms of when political party meetings are being held, the reversion to informal practices and cultures that really shut women out and exclude women, changes to candidate procedures, even the fact that elections may be being delayed and postponed. All these political shifts are also changing the environment for women's participation, and certainly for women's formal participation. So I think the vista is not particularly great, but I think that there are things we can do about it.
Absolutely. And I think women are recognizing that the skills that they have naturally as leaders, you know, greater compassion, the ability to truly empathize with others, that is, you know, core to leadership, particularly in difficult times.
Absolutely.
You know, and we saw that on display, and obviously there have been many memes of the, you know, of those seven who dealt with the crisis the best and who have emerged stronger for it, or all countries led by women. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, I shouldn't say exclusively. Do you think that the awareness, the talk of, oh, women are, you know, are great leaders through crisis, and we ought to hand them, you know, I mean, just the same way, right? In 2008, with the economic crisis, there was so much talk of, well, if Solomon Brothers was Solomon Sisters, we wouldn't have gotten into this mess. But yet things did really change, right? I mean, things certainly on Wall Street, you know, in terms of who's got power, didn't change that much, right? And certainly we saw more investments in women's economic empowerment, but sadly not enough to make the kind of dent to move, you know, the gender gap report in any significant way. So what do you think, as you talk with and meet with leaders around the world that you're working with, what do you think the impact of this crisis will be in terms of people looking to the kinds of leadership traits that women bring? And how do we make sure that the same thing that happened in 2008 doesn't happen again in 2021, where we acknowledge that, the world acknowledges that, but doesn't actually make the change?
And I think that's exactly the thing. I mean, you know, we know that their names, you know, just Jacinda Ardern, even Angela Merkel, all these women who did drive a very, you know, they had a good COVID, let's put it that way. But the challenge is not to essentialize them. Yes, they have specific leadership traits and specific leadership skills. And again, that other bastion of feminist radicalism, the Harvard Business Review, actually pointed out that women have more of the skills that are needed for leadership in crisis and in general than men do by a significant margin. So we know it, and we know that some women certainly display it, and it has been on view definitely in the last year. But I do think that it does go back to some of the other work that you and I do, Elise, which is to look at the supporting structures. First of all, how do you get to be a prime minister or a president in some of these countries? What are the underlying kind of what are the underlying mechanisms and pathways that have to be in place to allow that? And I think that the World Bank, for example, its women, business and law work shows the importance of some of the legal frameworks, the importance of the autonomy that some of the legal frameworks within a jurisdiction give to women. The more autonomous women are, the more likely they are to be able to step forward into the public space. So there are all these other aspects of the path to leadership and the leadership environment that also need to be bolstered so that we don't end up, to your point, with these seven have done well. Almost people thinking, wow, that's extraordinary. No, there are many, many, many women of the same caliber who aren't able to get through, who haven't made it through to that level. And the question is, how do we ensure that the systems and the pathways and the institutions are in place to allow them to do so? That's the only way we consolidate and solidify that the normality or the routineness of women's leadership.
And certainly we know women in public office get criticized, you know, at a much higher rate than men. They are seen as somehow easier targets.
Oh, yes.
They have larger, much larger rates of when they are incumbents running again, to have many more people see them as, you know, beatable and run against them. What is the trend that you are seeing? And of course, I know we've partnered on some great research around this, particularly around violence, harassment online for women. So the amount of violence against women leaders in the political space around the world is alarming.
I think this is a continuing disgrace, really, and damaging to democracy in its fundamental senses. You know, all violence against women and girls is bad and must be stopped, without doubt. And to finally have the recognition that the kind of pre-existing pandemic that the world was facing was indeed violence against women and girls is sort of bittersweet in some ways, because we've known this, we've been talking about this, at least you and I have been talking about this for decades. And for it almost for it to be called the shadow pandemic is almost adding insult to injury, because there's nothing shadow about it. It was the first, actually. So once we've established that violence against women and girls is rampant, it must be stopped, we need to accept that this is rooted in the fundamental gender inequalities and the fundamental disparities in power and empowerment and privilege between the genders that still persist. And so when women step forward into politics, which I call sort of the temple to masculinities, then of course the backlash is going to be even more trenchant and stronger. And what we're seeing now, I think, is definitely the weaponization of violence against women in politics in order to shore up authoritarian and illiberal influences. So it's I'm calling it more than mean. It's not just misogyny. These are deliberate political tactics to do two things. First of all, reduce the number of women, which is, you know, an electoral issue. You reduce the number of people, you might be able to finagle your elections. And then secondly, to constrain and limit the range of voices that are allowed into the political space. So this violence is deliberate, it's in person and online, it can be fatal, and we should pay a lot more attention to it.
So here in the United States, we've just passed the first 100 days of the new Biden administration. From your perspective, what are some of the foreign policy priorities when it comes to women and democracy for this new administration? Obviously, there are many challenges. Mm-hmm. We look out to, you know, our withdrawing completely from Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and what that will mean for women. You know, not that we, the United States, liberated women in any way, shape, or form. I like to remind people that in the 50s, you know, women were wearing skirts in Afghanistan.
Yes.
So this is not about, you know, we leave and, you know, everything goes to hell. I mean, it's a difficult situation now, and it's about to get a lot worse. But obviously so many other places, you know, Burma, I mean, there are challenges around the world, many COVID-induced, many not COVID-induced. Can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing as those priorities, or what you think those priorities ought to be?
There are a number of policy frameworks that are really in place and ready to be rolled out. I think for us, the Women, Peace and Security Act has a great ambition around women's political participation and the achievement of democratic political settlements, truly democratic political settlements that actually usher in eras of greater gender equality and women's empowerment over time. So I think, you know, moving forward with the implementation of the Women, Peace and Security Act, which was the first of its kind in the world, is a clear success and an achievable goal. And I know that is something that colleagues at the State Department are very focused on. I think there's an opportunity also with the Global Fragility Act to look and see how the issues around power impact state fragility, and to look at that with an inclusive and a gender-informed lens, I think will be important. And as that act moves through to implement what strategy and implementation, that might be another opportunity where there's a clear foreign policy framework within which we can do more on women's political empowerment. And I think the other area is, it's much lower level, but it's the point that you just raised, Alice, is that this business about training women to be politically active, this is not a pro- I mean, women don't need any more training. They're already there, they can do it. They need help and support to adjust, as we said earlier, legal frameworks or party rules or whatever it is. But importantly, I think we must provide a lot more support to how safe they are, to their actual safety and security as they go about the work. We are seeing many more women in politics, women journalists, human rights defenders, environmental activists, being assaulted, assailed, assassinated. And I think it's incumbent upon us as we support their personal capabilities in these areas to ensure that they are able to undertake some level of safety planning and risk mitigation. Never to zero, but we've got to give them something as they walk the world.
Mm-hmm. Senator, thank you so much for spending your time with us today. It's always an inspiration to spend time with you and chat and hear your perspective. So thank you again.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Elise. It's been a pleasure. And we don't see enough of each other. We must correct that as soon as we can.
We don't. I have one more question as we close here. What is your power? How do you use it to empower?
It's going to sound weird. I think the fact that I am boringly consistent is my power. I'm able to gain people's confidence and trust. And I am careful not to abuse or lose it. So it's just about showing up and being present in a consistent way. I think people pretty much know where I'm coming from most of the time. And I think that's important. Not a very good answer, but I can't think of anything else.
I think that's wonderful. And you know, there are many easy ways out of that question. And I think, you know, you took the more complex route, and I love that. I mean, it's always interesting to see what people will say and dig deep and think about that. So thank you again, Sandra. I so enjoyed this conversation. Thank you. And we will have to see each other more. I hope one of these favorite women discussions is going to happen in person one of these days.
Absolutely, Elise. And until then, aluta continua.
Thanks for listening to this special edition of the Vital Voices podcast. If you'd like to support our work with women leaders who use their power to empower others, you can donate to Vital Voices on our website at vitalvoices.org, or you can text VITAL to 41444. That's VITAL to 41444. See you next week.